Okay, it's now 3 o'clock. So, Genkosetsu Sutta, out of respect. We can do the Namo task first of all. I'm just checking, make sure, yes, I am wearing my brace, my necklace. with the microphone on. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So today's sutta is again from the middle length discourses, imperfections, and the word imperfections is upakilesa. Kilesa is sometimes a word used for the sometimes called poisons, basically greed, hatred, and delusion. But this is upakilesa. When you have the word upa, it means to be more refined, imperfections. And as you will see, it describes and gives the antidotes to the very refined defilements, obstacles, which occur in the mind when you're developing nimittas. And just once those nimittas are overcome, then the jhanas happen. But it's also interesting because it describes one of the experiences in the time of the Buddha. Sometimes people always feel, oh, the Sangha of monks and the Sangha of nuns are so wise and holy, they live so peacefully together. But there was an incident in the town of Kosambi where the monks had a big argument. And if you want to, don't say it here, but what actually happened was that there were two senior monks there. One was the expert on the suttas, on the teachings. The other one was the expert on the Vinaya. And when the Vinaya expert, I think, went to the toilet, or the other way, I forget which, but maybe the sutta one went to the toilet, then there was, once washing the bowl afterwards, there was not enough water left. And he didn't fill up the bowl afterwards. It's such a small thing. But then they said, you should fill up the bowl after you've been to the toilet for the next person who goes. He said, but there was no water. That's no excuse, you should fill up the bowl. But I couldn't. But you should. But I didn't. So I wouldn't. And you get these silly arguments which come up. But also interesting, there was this argument, and when the Buddha heard it got sort of very hot, starts off with silly things, with small things, and builds up to something which is really quite fierce. And he tried to sort it out. So he went there himself. And the monks who were there at the time said, oh, you just live peacefully and quietly, you know, the Buddha. You know, we'll sort this out ourselves. Because they were so upset and angry, they didn't even listen to their teacher. So anyway, let's see what it says. And there's some other verses there which are very, very common in Buddhism and which you may already have heard. But nevertheless, this is the story behind it. Imperfections. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Buddha was living at Kosambi in Gosita's park. Now on that occasion, the monks at Kosambi had taken to quarrelling and brawling and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. That was just a standard description of they were not living in harmony and were arguing. Then a certain monk went to the Buddha, and having paid homage to him, he stood at one side and said, Venerable Sir, the monks here at Kosambi have taken to quarrelling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. It would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Buddha would go to those monks out of compassion. And the Buddha consented in silence. There used to be a way that the monks would agree in those days they will consent in silence. But please don't try that with the monks and nuns here, because if you ask, oh, Ajahn Brahm, after the retreat, can I stay a bit longer? And then you quickly run away and say, well, Ajahn Brahm never said anything. So he must have consented in silence. So remember, over here, get a response, not a silent one. Then the Buddha went to those monks and said to them, enough, monks, let there be no quarrelling, brawling, wrangling or dispute. When this was said, a certain monk said to the Buddha, wait, venerable sir, let the Buddha, the Lord of the Dhamma, live at ease, devoted to a pleasant abiding here and now. We are the ones who will be responsible for this quarrelling, brawling, wrangling and dispute. And they say, everything's always done three times in Buddhism. For a second time, for a third time, the Buddha said, enough, monks. Let there be no quarrelling, brawling, wrangling or dispute. And for a third time, that monk said to the Buddha, enough, venerable sir. We are the ones who will be responsible for this quarrelling, brawling, wrangling and dispute. So he asked them three times, and they just basically told him to just go off and meditate. Then when it was morning, the Buddha dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, entered Kosambi for alms, his morning meal. When he had wandered for alms in Kosambi, and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he set his resting place in order, took his bowl and outer robe, and while standing, uttered these stanzas. He was about to leave Kosambi, but it just shows you that how free that lifestyle of monks and nuns was in those days. You can just go for your alms round, have your meal, and then it took, you know, a few minutes to pack your belongings, just a bowl and spare robe, and to put your place in order, and then depart. And they said these stanzas, when many voices shout at once, none considers himself a fool. Though the Sangha is being split, none thinks himself to be at fault. They have forgotten thoughtful speech. They talk obsessed by words alone. Uncurbed their mouths, they bawl at will. None knows what leads him so to act. He abused me. He struck me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who harbour thoughts like these, hatred will never be allayed. He abused me, he struck me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who do not harbour thoughts like these, hatred will readily be allayed. For in this world, hatred is never allayed by further acts of hate. It is allayed by non-hatred or by love, by metta. This is the fixed and ageless law. Those others do not recognize that here we should restrain ourselves. But those wise ones who realize this at once end all their enmity. Restraining yourself, not others. And you end your enmity there. Breakers of bones and murderers, those who steal cattle, horses, wealth, those who pillage the entire realm, when even these can act together, why can you not do so too? If one can find a worthy friend, a virtuous, steadfast companion, then overcome all threats of danger and walk with them, content and mindful. I like that phrase too, the content and mindful. But if one finds no worthy friend, no virtuous, steadfast companion, then as a king leaves his conquered realm, walk like a tusker in the woods alone. Better it is to walk alone. There is no companionship with fools. Walk alone and do no evil, at ease like a Tuscan elephant in the woods. And because there's quite a few Vietnamese here, the time I went to Vietnam, one time I went to Vietnam, it was in the north of Vietnam, and on the way between Hanoi and Ha Long Bay, there was a mountain, and that was a mountain where one of the kings of Vietnam, or that part of Vietnam in the north, that he resigned his kingdom, he walked away, went up into the mountains and became a monk. Do you know that story? You do, yeah. What was the king's name? You know? I don't know, but you know the story, good. And I remember going up there, and it was inspiring. It was a mountain, it was very steep and very high up. But you know, once you were up there, I was inspired that just the king, you know, who had lots of pleasures of the five senses and lots of power, he decided to give it all up and walk up there to the mountain just to become a monk. And apparently that did a really great deal to inspire the people in Vietnam that this Buddhism had something very attractive to it. And he was a great monk up there. Better it is to walk alone. There is no companionship with fools. Walk alone and do no evil. And he is like a tusker in the woods. Then, having uttered these stanzas while standing, the Buddha went to the village of Balakalonikara. On that occasion, the Venerable Bhagu was living at the village of Balakalonikara. In those days, that nuns as well could live almost anywhere. And because your needs were very little, all you needed was a bowl of food a day. And because of that, it was very easy to find a place to stay. And easy climate, so you can build yourself a little hut and stay there. You didn't need much to survive. So that meant that you could stay so many places. So when the Venerable Bhagu saw the Buddha coming in the distance, he prepared a seat and set out water for washing the feet. And many times, monks in those days didn't wear sandals. So because of that, their feet would get dirty, and it was just in order to wash people's feet when they first arrived. And you see that happening, especially in Sri Lankan traditions, when you go and visit people's house. Sometimes that when I go to a Sri Lankan house for a dana or an evening speech, bana, then I get out of the car and I take off my sandals and then I have my feet washed. As if I'd walked all the way from Nolamara through the dirty streets, and then you have your feet washed when you get there. And some of these traditions, you say, why do you do that? Because it reminds me just of how things were in the time of the Buddha and the simplicity. And it's one of the things you needed to do before you got into the house. So, the Buddha sat down on a seat made ready and washed his feet. Then the Venerable Bhagu paid homage to the Buddha and sat down on one side. And the Buddha said to him, I hope you are keeping well, monk. I hope you are comfortable. I hope you are not having any trouble getting alms food. And that became the standard greeting from a senior monk to a junior monk. And sometimes in reference to that, you know, that you go and visit someone and that's what you ask. Are you getting enough alms food? Are you comfortable? The first thing you make sure, if you have power, like I do, I have influence on the Buddhist Society West Australia Committee, so I have to make sure that they've got enough alms food, enough stuff to keep themselves going. And then the Buddha instructed, urged, roused and gladdened the Venerable Bhagu with a talk on Dhamma. So you always ask, you know, physical safety first of all, and comfort and well-being. And then you taught the Dhamma. Sorry I never asked you that when I taught the Dhamma, the first talk here in Jhana Grove. I didn't ask each one of you, are you getting enough food? Are you comfortable? Because I know that you probably are, because I know this place. And on that occasion, he urged, roused, and gladdened the Venerable Bhagu with a talk on the Dhamma, after which he rose from his seat and went to the eastern bamboo park. Of course, there's many bamboo groves. This bamboo park was not the one which was outside of Rajagaha. This is a totally separate one. They called it Bamboo Park simply because it was bamboo there. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbala were living at the eastern bamboo park, those three monks. And the park keeper saw the Buddha coming in the distance and told him, "Do not enter this park, recluse. There are three clansmen here seeking their own good. Do not disturb them." Now, sometimes people thought that the Buddha would really stand out physically so everybody would know who he was. This is one example here that, you know, the park keeper couldn't even recognize the Buddha. And then the Venerable Anuruddha heard the park keeper speaking to the Blessed One and told him, "Friend, park keeper, do not keep the Buddha out. It is our teacher, the Buddha, who has come." Then the Venerable Anuruddha went to the Venerable Nandiya and the Venerable Kimbala and said, "Come out, Venerable Sirs, come out. Our teacher, the Buddha, has come." Then all three, for those watching in Singapore, this is just some hay fever. My nose is leaking. But I have taken some medicine. The Buddha has come. Then all three went to meet the Buddha. One took his bowl and outer robe. One prepared a seat, and one set out water for washing the feet. The Buddha sat down on the seat made ready and washed his feet. Then those three venerable ones paid homage to the Buddha and sat down at one side. It's okay here in this hall here, but usually, you know, when somebody is giving a talk, if they're a senior monk, you never sit right in front of them, because that's considered to be a little bit asking for attention. You always sit a little bit to one side. And that's, you know, a lovely tradition there. And then all three, sat down to one side. And the Buddha said to them, "I hope you are keeping well, Anuruddha. I hope you are comfortable. I hope you are not having any trouble getting alms food." I'm just going to point out a little bit in that statement. It may seem strange to you that when the Buddha said, "I hope you are keeping well, Anuruddha," he's only pointing out, speaking to one of them, the leader, Anuruddha. What about Kimbala and Nandiya? And the reason is, that's just the idiom there. If, you know, if four nuns come and see, and you want to talk to them, you would address them all as Gotami. Gotami, how are you all? Yeah, but not just speaking to you, speaking to every one of you, four. The senior one is always gets the word called, that sort of points you four out, and it really means all four of you. And that's interesting afterwards. It's just an idiom of Pali. If you have like three or four or five in a common list, just saying the first one or the first two implies all the others. And that's important in something like the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha says, before doing any of the four Satipatthanas, you must make sure that you've restrained the Lokeya Bija and Dhammasangha. And those two are very easily identified with the first two hindrances. The first hindrance is usually Kamachanda. But in many places, I remember doing a little bit of research, 40 or 50 places, instead of Kamachanda, they use the word Lokaya Bija, as is used in the Satipatthana Sutta. And Dhammanasa in two suttas, that is a synonym for Avayapada, the second hindrance. But anyway, those two hindrances are very clearly identified with the things which you should restrain before you do the Satipatthana. And it's in the commentaries which confirm that. And they also pointed out that when you mention two of a very, very standard group, such as the five hindrances, and you mention the first two, you should understand it means the whole of that group. Not just the first two hindrances, but all the five hindrances. So it says the commentaries, they say this is just the way that Pali was used in those days. So anyway, that's what it means. And this is an example here. You see these three meditating monks, and you just address them by the senior one of them, Aniruddha, but it means all of them. So, I hope you are keeping well, Aniruddha. It also means Kimbala and Nandiya. I hope you are comfortable. I hope you are not having trouble getting alms food. We are keeping well, although we are comfortable, we're not having any trouble getting alms food. That was the first question. Are you comfortable there? Second question, I hope, Aniruddha, that you are all living in harmony with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like, I'll say milk and water. I was just going to say condensed milk and cup of tea. But that's my nature. I was just brainwashed into me by my father. How are you blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes? And surely, Venerable Sir, we are living in harmony with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And I just point out, why did the Buddha say that? Because that is important. It's almost crucial. If you want to have success in developing very deep states of meditation and understanding the Dhamma, we have to find some way of living in harmony and peace and together. And when you point those things out, people think, oh no, to actually develop deep meditation, just to put effort, sit a long time, really could get into it. But it's saying, no, it's by developing harmony and peace, looking out for one another, that is also essential. And the Buddha asked, but Aniruddha, how do you live like that? Venerable Sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a gain for me. It is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards these venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. And I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? And I set aside what I want to do and do what these venerable ones want to do. We are different in body, Venerable Sir, but one in mind. The Venerable Nandi and the Venerable Kimbala each spoke likewise, adding, that is how, Venerable Sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And that really inspired me when I first read that. It still inspires me today. Just how a community of nuns, a community of monks, a community meditating on retreat can get huge benefits in their meditation. For everyone you see here, viewing them with kindly eyes, blending like milk and water. It is true you don't need to speak to one another, but if you keep silence, please smile at one another when you pass by. Just a little smile. It means that you are giving kindness to the people you're sharing your cottage with, the people you're sharing this place with, you're developing that sense of a community. Different bodies, but single mind. And good Anuruddha, I hope that you all abide diligent, ardent and resolute. Once you have that kindness there and that harmony, then the diligence, ardent and resolute. This is more like the effort which people keep talking about. Surely, Venerable Sir, we abide diligent, ardent and resolute. But Anuruddha, how do you do that? How do you abide thus? Venerable Sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts a refuse bucket in its place, whichever of us returns last from alms round, eats any food left over if they wish. Otherwise he throws it away where there's no greenery or drops it into water where there is no life. So you're not polluting the environment. He puts away the seats and the water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing or the latrine are low or empty, he takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. But every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. That is how we abide diligent, ardent and resolute. And again, when I started taking over the leadership of Bodhidharma Monastery, I always remembered that they didn't have meetings every night. They didn't have meetings in the morning and the evening. They were in this for long term. Every 5 days they would meet together, discuss and inspire one another. And then they would just have this beautiful silence for the rest of the next 4 or 5 days. And they would always help each other. They didn't need to ask. And it's just like, I must admit, it's good that Leha's not here today, but you know, she doesn't appoint people to do the duties, just asks, does anyone need to do this? We need some help here. And she finds there's always people who volunteer to do those services. And if you find someone's forgotten or they're sick and they can't come today, then you just see if you can do it yourself. It's not somebody's duty, it's our duty to make sure that everything is kept clean and everything is organized. And if someone needs some help, of course you help them. It's a very beautiful system of trusting. Good Anuruddha. But while you abide thus, diligent, ardent and resolute, have you attained any superhuman states, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding? And this gets into the heart of the sutta. Because these, what they call here, superhuman states, a distinction of knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding. What he's referring to there is the jhanas, the attainments in deep wisdom, stream winning, once returning, non-returning, full arahat. Because this is what they were meditating for. And one thing here, it says that they call it superhuman states. It's a very difficult word. It's uttari manusa dhamma. And it literally does mean like superior or really incredible states attainable by a human being. And I always mention that because sometimes these days that people just they lessen the importance and the power of things like a jhana. One good example of that, you know, when I first came over to Perth, I was just helping out on a retreat, and I asked one gentleman, he was on the retreat, it was only a weekend retreat, you know, how's it going? And he said, oh, not very good. I said, why was that? And he said, oh, my meditation is not good. I can only get first jhana this retreat, I just cannot get the second jhana. I'm glad you laughed, because you know, I was almost going to cry. Simply because, you know, if you have even come close to a first jhana, you cannot be so sad and morose. These are huge states. And so huge that in some traditions where we haven't got the Buddhist view and background, sometimes even just get into a first jhana. Many people who have that and don't know exactly what they're doing consider it to be like a union with God. It's powerful, huge. You know, you as you knew yourself and not there, huge amounts of bliss and stillness. This is a really incredible state of mind. And to think that, oh, I just got first jhana, I can't get second. That is just so impossible. What you're doing is not the jhanas, if that's how you feel. You got first jhana. Oh. It may sound silly to you, but it just really blows you. So anyway, that's why they call them superhuman. They're immense in their power. And if anyone does get a jhana here, walking on air. I don't mean literally, not levitating, I mean just one of the biggest things in your life. Plural. And okay. And Venerable says, have you achieved any, experienced any of these things? And he asks, Venerable Sir, as we abide here diligent, ardent and resolute, we perceive both light and a vision of forms. Soon afterwards, the light and the vision of forms disappear. We have not discovered a cause for that. And every 5 days they discuss, you know, and the problems they experience in meditation. The light, vision of forms. What does that mean? That's what I describe as those nimitters. Get really, really still. Your body is vanishing. And you see these wonderful lights in the mind. And you know, they have forms to them. Sometimes they have the form of a monster, like I described the other day. Or many other, you know, interesting, beautiful stuff. And of course the light is, you know, very stands out, because it's gorgeous. And so you can understand what the Buddha's talking about here. And this is, you know, that sutta when people say, oh, the Buddha never talked about nimittas. So this is the sutta where he discusses it at length. And the Buddha replies, that nimitta should be penetrated, comprehended, Anuruddha. Before my enlightenment, where it says over here, the translation which Bhikkhu Bodhi did, and I argued with him about this translation. I said, you're not really just showing that there's a nimitta involved in here. When the Bhikkhu Bodhi translated, what I translated is that nimitta should be penetrated, comprehended. The Bhikkhu Bodhi translated, you should discover the cause for that. That's okay, but the cause for what? What is actually happening there? It is nimittas. That nimitta should be penetrated, comprehended, Anuruddha. And then the Buddha continues, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too perceived both light and the vision of forms. Soon afterwards, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. I thought, what is the cause and condition why the light and the vision of forms have disappeared? This is standard, really good meditation instructions. When there's a problem there, when you come out afterwards, why? Why did that problem exist? What's the solution to it? This is where you get huge insights. Insights into how to deepen your meditation, but also insights into just how we overreact to what happens in our meditation, how we destroy the stillness by getting involved. So, I thought, what is the cause and condition why the light and the vision of forms have disappeared? Then I considered thus, doubt arose in me, and because of the doubt, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, that's another samadhi, just nothing's moving. When the stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. I shall so act that doubt will not arouse in me again. Now that's the first of these upikalesa, and one of the reasons it's there is because it's just so incredibly common. I don't know how many people, when they come to the interview time, they said, well, you know, I was getting very peaceful in meditation, I saw this light, but it can't be an imitator. And this is my own experience talking to people, that as you talk to them, 90% of the time minimum, it was a nimitta. And it was such an important point to me to get rid of that doubt, that when you do see a light, 9 out of 10 times it is a real one. Why do you have doubt? It's not. One of the reasons you have doubt, because you think, I'm just a lay person. I've only just started meditation. I can't do this sort of stuff. This is big league. It is way beyond me. It's not. Of course you can experience it. And to tell you an honest truth, that this Dharma hall here, the design of it, I designed this thing. You see those windows up there? Can you get like the sun just actually sending light through these windows? So you look at the window and see this beautiful light in there, and think, oh, this is not a nimitta inside of my meditation. This is the light shining in my eyes. It can't be. That was one of the reasons why you've got no choice. You have to admit it's real. And overcome that doubt. Okay. So, of course you can do it. Otherwise I would be wasting my time. And as Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent, ardent, and resolute. I perceived both light and vision of forms, and soon afterwards the light and the vision of forms disappeared. I thought, what is the cause and condition why the light and the vision of forms have disappeared? And I considered inattention arose in me. And because of inattention, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. I shall so act that neither doubt nor inattention will arise in me again. So, why is it inattention happens? Sometimes it is like you see those lights and say, oh yeah, I've got the nimitta now what do I do? The nimitta is right in front of you. It's the most important thing in the whole world. And that just teaching, this most important thing in the whole world, of course it makes you attentive to it. If you, you know, just, okay, done that one, now what? Then that's inattention. So when these things happen, trust it is a real nimitta. And it's important. So you attend to it. It's usually very happy and very joyful. And once it starts to really develop, that joy and happiness, you can't really take your eyes off it. As Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent, I considered thus. Sloth and torpor arose in me. And because of sloth and torpor, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappear. I shall so act that neither doubt nor inattention nor sloth and torpor will arise in me again. This is the dullness, the sleepiness. A lot of times, just stay there with a nimitta. It just really builds up your energy. You don't feel tired at all or dull in your mind. After a while, sloth and torpor is overcome, as I said earlier, from my own experience when I was in Thailand, of eating enough. Your body needs energy. Not too much, not too little. Drinking enough. And I say that because a couple of years ago, on the rains retreat, there was one of the people who was meditating there, and in the afternoon I was over in Bodhinyana or my own retreat or something, but she thought she had a stroke. And she was taken to Amada Hospital. And what they found out was that she was just dehydrated. I said, why did you get dehydrated? And the reason was, it's because she wanted to sit 2 or 3 hours at a time. And if after an hour and a half, she wanted to go to the toilet. So to stop the irritation of having to go to the toilet, she didn't drink very much. And as a result, she was just dehydrated, that's all. And I mention that because sometimes, you know, when you do retreats, especially it's quite warm in this room, and you know, getting to summertime, please make sure you're well hydrated. If you really get into a deep meditation, don't worry about going to the toilet, you just won't feel it. You can go after the retreat is finished. After the meditation, not after the retreat, the retreat's 9 days. Didn't mean that. So, as Anuruddha, and that means the sloth and the torpor, the dullness is gone, and you really get some good energy. So make sure you drink enough, eat enough, and also sleep enough, and exercise enough. You can go for walks. Walking meditation, if you don't like the walking meditation, just go for one of the walks along the trails. Okay. As an Anuruddha, I was abiding, diligent, I considered thus. Fear arose in me, and because of fear, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. Suppose a man set out on a journey, and murderers leaped out on both sides of him. Then fear would arise in him because of that. So fear arose in me, and the light of the vision of forms disappeared. I considered thus, I shall so act that neither doubt nor inattention nor sloth and torpor nor fear will arise in me again. And of course, that is one of the very common obstacles to the meditation. And that is my job, to say, look, the meditation is great. You've got nothing to be afraid of except losing your hair, but that's easy. So you don't really need to do that. But the fear which comes up, why? Two reasons. One is that you're going to a place you've never been to before, and just the lack of familiarity. It's just like you, then some of you come to the retreat here for the first time. What is this place? Who is this teacher? Am I going to be able to take it here? Look at the schedule. Oh, crikey, get up at 4 o'clock with gusto. Who is this gusto fellow I'm supposed to get up with? Someone said that. And of course, you know, the first thing I say, it's okay to sleep in. You don't always have to sit here. You can sit on a chair. You can take it easy. So overcome that fear. That it's a calm, safe place. And by now you should have understood there's nothing which is going to harm you here, but everything to really give you a big boost of happiness and energy and health. So, there's nothing to be afraid of. That's the first one. You're going to places you've never been to before. Well, after a while, like even now, your room and your, you know, where you sleep. Now, first of all, I think, what is this? But now it's your bed. You've got to know the bed. You've got to know your pillow. And it's also just, I feel happy in here. You feel safe and comfortable. You got used to it. And that's what happens. All these stages of meditation. First of all, you have recognition. You know it's your room. Then you have familiarity. You know where everything is. And you're at ease with it. And then you have this, again, the ease is the last thing. Recognition, familiarity and ease. And after a while, this is my room. You can have a really good night's sleep in it. Know where everything is and how it works. So that fear is also the other thing which fear comes up with is that these are very powerful states of mind. I mean, really powerful. You're actually finding some truth. And sometimes, for many people, they'd rather live in fallacy, in delusion, because you got used to delusion. Do you really want to face that truth? And because I haven't seen this, but some of the younger monks were saying that there was a movie, it was The Matrix. And anyway, they were saying in The Matrix, you're in some sort of delusional world, but you can take one of two pills, as a white pill, a black pill, or something? Red or blue. And I don't know which one does what, But anyway, say the red pill breaks you out of the delusion, and the blue pill keeps you in delusion or something. Is that right? The other way, okay. But anyway, why would people want to be in delusion? It's actually scary being real. There's that fear there of facing really deep reality. Well, I don't know why, because you know, with the meditations, it's positive always. And you see all these great monks and nuns who get these experiences, and oh, they're all positive about it. I've never met one monk or nun or layperson who said after they've got these jhanas, oh, they wish they hadn't done this. Never one. So, please, there's no fear. I've got to laugh at you again now. There's many other things you might regret in life, but not that. But fear is very common. So if you have fear come up, I know this monk, I'm very close to him, but he was, that was one of his big problems. You get sort of the really powerful nimittas, having a really great time, and then it's like, just as like a simile, like jhana is just over there. It's easy. But you can't get in there, it's too big for you. You're only a small monk. And the jhana's over there. And it's just, oh, it's so lovely, but I can't do that. I don't know what might happen. The jhana's just over there, it looks so nice. Well, the fear is, the closer you get, the bigger the fear is. But then for some people, you say, oh, why the hell not? And you just go for it. For some monks I know, the joy of it, just the peace, the power, the brilliance, the profundity of it was so powerful that that's what overcome the fear. You can't resist it. As Anuruddha was abiding diligent, I consider thus, inertia arose in me, and because of inertia my stillness fell away. Okay. Elation. Oh, yeah. So elation arose in me. Because of elation, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and vision of forms disappeared. So suppose a man seeking one entrance to a hidden treasure. Or let's not say hidden treasure, we don't have that. A man or woman saw the lottery numbers for next week's lottery. All there. Ooh, not just one set of numbers, but a set of numbers for the next month. Hadn't been drawn then, but you know that's true. Then elation would arise in you because of that. So to elation arose in me, the light and vision of forms disappeared. That is the excitement. Wow! Yes! At last! Yay! And that just disturbs everything. Oh dear. And it all falls apart. Oh my goodness, what did I do that for? You get elated afterwards, when you emerge out of the jhanas, but not beforehand. And I remember I told this to somebody, they remembered the story, I was really happy they remembered the story, that I taught some of these teachings to a husband of one of the Thai ladies. He passed away recently, it was a shame. But anyway, he was a photographer for our local Sunday Times newspaper. And, you know, Sunday Times, really nothing much happens in Perth. You know, it's not the centre of the world. But then there was a rumour going around that Kylie Minogue, that she, sorry? Yeah, Kylie Minogue, that she had some sort of breakdown. And you know, because of the pressure of being a celebrity, and that she had escaped, only a rumour, to Broome, to Cable Beach Resort, and was hiding out there. And so the editor had heard that and said to this guy, you know, the husband of the Thai girl who comes here, and said, do you want to go up to Cable Beach Resort? And just, you know, it's only a rumour, probably not true, but just go up and check it out just in case. And of course, would you refuse an invitation to go to Cable Beach Resort? Oh yeah, I'll go up there. So off he went, got a plane up there, all paid for by the newspaper. And he's a really good guy, but he had to be like the paparazzi climbing over the fence. sort of crawling quietly through the bush. And he got to, you know, where the alleged cabin was, where Kylie Minogue, and that was true. He saw her. It was real. The biggest moment of his professional life to get the scoop on Kylie Minogue. He didn't think about the morals of it, just about poor old Kylie, she needed a bit of peace and quiet. But he took out his camera and he remembered the simile. Don't be afraid. Don't be elated. The same similes that I taught him about Nimitz. And he got the shot. He says the biggest scoop of his life. For him, it was really a big deal. And he told me about it afterwards. I was laughing my head off. But that's not how you use these techniques, okay? They're supposed to be just for nimitas, but just be still. Elation will cause the stillness to fall away. As I was abiding diligent, I considered thus, inertia arose in me, and because of inertia my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and vision of forms disappeared. I shall so act that these things, including inertia, will not arise in me again. The inertia didn't have enough energy. And inertia is when, what is it, that it's almost like you've run out of fuel. It's not the fuel of doing something, it's the fuel of letting go, of renunciation, of giving up things. That didn't have much power. Later on, when you get into the jhanas, you can't do anything in there. It's how much that power of letting go, of renunciation, you take into that jhana. If you've got huge amounts of power, just you go, you know, into a first jhana, second and third and fourth. Because it's the way you go in, with that degree of power of letting go. It's not personal power. It's renunciation power, if you want to know anything. And that takes you deep into the jhanas. You can't be in a first jhana and say, no, I want to go into a second jhana. You're still too still to do anything like that. But anyway, that's the inertia was a problem. 22, as Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent, I consider this excess of energy arose in me. And because of excess of energy, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. Suppose a man were to grip a quail tightly with both hands, he would die there and then. It's not a very nice simile, but nevertheless. So to an excess of energy arose in me. You get close and you just want to grip it tighter. So just no excess of energy, just let it develop by itself. As Anuruddha was abiding diligent, I considered thus deficiency of energy arose in me. And because of deficiency of energy, my stillness fell away. When the stillness fell away, the light and the visions and forms disappeared. Suppose a man were to grip a quail loosely, it would fly out of his hands. So I made sure that didn't happen again. As Anuruddha was abiding diligent, I considered that longing arose in me. And because of that longing, my stillness and fell away. And my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. I shall so act that neither any of these things, and especially longing, will arise in me again. I want something. It can be many things. It can be that longing just, you know, want to get out, or the longing to go deeper, longing for it to happen soon. All those old wantings disturb the stillness. Remember the leaf on the tree which I mentioned this morning? Only moves because of the wind. The wind stops. It moves less and less. Then you want something and it starts moving again. You destroy the stillness. As Anuruddha was abiding diligent, I considered thus. Perception of diversity arose in me. And because of perception of diversity, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. I shall so act that neither doubt nor inattention, nor longing nor perception of diversity will arise in me again. Now I was wondering about this when I was a young meditator, and because I read that sometimes the meditations are like, you can watch like stars, and they said it's really important. Now, what shape is that, that star, or that, that ball of light, or whatever it is? And I started really being concerned about that, because when I tried to sort of see its sort of shape, or, you know, just how big it was, or whether it was really round, or what it was, it would always disappear. And I thought, what I was really doing, I was looking at the that interface where the nimitta stopped and the what's outside the nimitta began. Even that, just, you know, looking at, here we go, looking at this. What are you seeing? You're seeing the bell, or what's outside of it? Or you're seeing the edge of it? I was seeing the edge of it. That's where the diversity was, the inside, outside. And that was what was causing problems. Because some teachers would actually say, learn to expand the nimitta and then contract it. Learn to move it around. To actually do that, you needed the perceptions of diversity. When I saw it in here, I thought, oh yeah, that's the problem. Just go into the center of the nimitta, where there's a unity there. Just, you know, one single color, just one beautiful light. And this, don't see edges. In edges, there's diversity. Oops. As Aniruddha's abiding diligent, I consider thus. Excessive meditation on forms arose in me. Because of excessive meditation upon forms, my stillness fell away. That is actually, again, similar. When you see, is this circular, is this round, is it square, is it a diamond shape, or what's going on? So I made sure the excessive meditation on forms will not arise in me again. When Aniruddha understood, okay, that, oh, when I understood that doubt is an imperfection of the mind, an upikalesa, I abandoned doubt, inattention, sloth, torpor, fear, elation, inertia, excess of energy, deficiency of energy, longing, perception of diversity, excessive meditation upon forms is an imperfection of the mind, I abandon these. Usually these things, you know, once you hear about this and once you develop it, many of these things you don't even notice because you go right past them because it's so attractive, it's quite natural. But if you have a problem, this is where the solutions are. Sometimes those problems don't come up. As Aniruddha, I was abiding, diligent, ardent, resolute. I perceived light, but I did not see forms, the shape of the light. And many times that people see weird shapes. It doesn't really matter, they're fine. But in the end, these things will all settle down. And I saw forms, did not perceive light, even for a whole night or a whole day or a whole day and night. And I thought, what is the cause and condition for this? I consider thus, on the occasion when I do not attend to the sign of forms, but attend to the sign of light, I then perceive light but not forms. On the occasion when I do not attend to the light nimitta, but attend to the form nimitta, I see forms but not perceive light, even for a whole day or night or a whole day and night. As Aniruddha, I was abiding, diligent, ardent and resolute, I perceived limited light and saw limited forms, immeasurable light and immeasurable forms. Even for a whole day and night, or a whole day and night. I thought, what is the cause and condition for this? Then I consider on the occasion when stillness is limited, the samadhi, the stillness, you haven't been in the stillness long enough, my vision is limited. And with limited vision I perceive limited light and limited forms. But on the occasion when stillness is immeasurable, my vision is immeasurable. With immeasurable vision, I perceive immeasurable light and see immeasurable forms. Even for a whole day, a night, a whole day, and a whole day and night. Sorry, I keep getting that. But you get the point. With Aniruddha, I understood that doubt is an imperfection of mind, and had abandoned doubt. I understand inattention is an imperfection of the mind, and had abandoned inattention. Abandoned sloth and torpor, abandoned fear, abandoned elation. Abandon inertia, abandon excess of energy, abandon deficiency of energy, abandon longing, abandon perception of diversity, abandon excessive meditation upon forms and imperfection of the mind. And I thought, I have abandoned those imperfections of the mind. Let me now develop stillness in three ways. So all those imperfections he'd learned to abandon. What is stillness in three ways? Thereupon, Aniruddha, I developed the first jhana. And that is with the movement of the mind onto the object and holding onto the object. I develop the stillness between the first and second jhana. This is almost like a one and a half jhana, which is mentioned in a few places. That is where no vitaka, no moving on to the object. The reason why the object of bliss, you know, is, I call it like a wobble, you're still holding on to the object of bliss very lightly, but there's still a little bit of doubt, a little bit of faith, and if you don't hold on, you'll fall off. And that little bit of holding, lack of confidence that this is going to be quite safe and still, that means you fall off, but then you go straight back on again. And that is the vitaka, is just going on again. The vichara is the cause of the problem here, you're just holding on, still, slightly, very slightly, but still with the vichara. And when that vichara disappears, the holding on to the object of bliss, then you move from the in between the first and second jhana to the real second jhana. A lot of the times that place between the first and second jhana with no vitaka but vichara is so similar to the second jhana that often they don't even mention it. It's included in the second jhana experience simply because it's still. And so I develop stillness with the rapture, without rapture, and accompanied by enjoyment, and accompanied by equanimity, fourth jhana, or without vitaka and vichara. So when Aniruddha had developed the first jhana, between the first and second jhana, and the other three jhanas, the knowledge and vision arose in me. My deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no more renewal of being. That is what the Buddha said. And the Venerable Aniruddha was satisfied and delighted in the Buddha's words. But not just Aniruddha, also Kimbala and Nandiya too. When it says just Aniruddha, it means the other two as well. And that is the Upekalesa Sutta. And you got your own copies here, you can take home with you if anything happens. You get nimittas coming up. You got a little How to Do It guidebook there, which is great. Biggest problems, fear and excitement. I always say that. Doubt is also a brilliant first one to put up. If you see a light in the mind, I mean, when you first start meditating, sometimes it's just you're like a car cooling down after you've been driving. It's heat, but the engine's not running. Then it's just the mind just on the five senses still slowing down when you first close your eyes. So don't worry about what happens in the first few minutes of meditation. But later on, when you get pretty peaceful and still, and beautiful light comes up, 9 times out of 10, it really is a limiter. Don't get excited. Don't get afraid. Don't go, yay! Develop it. Let it become still and get really bright and light and beautiful. And the other thing, you know, it's really a nimitta, is the colours. And that's something which really stands out, that if it's like a yellow nimitta, the colour is not important, but the intensity of the colour is. It's like yellows you've never seen before in the so-called real world. Intense colours, pure colours. They often say it's hard to describe because they're not available for people to see with their eyes, but it's like more yellow than yellow, more white than white. That's the most accurate way of describing them. And they're fascinating and beautiful, give you lots of joy and happiness. And please, just enjoy that. Don't try and say, I've got limited now, I've got to do something else. No, just enjoy that, that's good enough for you. And I say that because if you're at peace with it, then it can deepen. Yeah, you had a question there.
Yes, thank you. Ajahn Brahm, when the Buddha says that he developed
the jhana,
could you just clarify, does developed mean, does it mean that he created it or that he achieved it?
No, he took away all the obstacles to it. In other words, how do you develop a garden? By protecting all the flowers which you planted there. They grow by themselves. If we can only get out of the way and let go, then these jhanas just happen. And it's a strange thing to say, but a lot of times we mess up because we try and make it happen. And what you do instead, this is Ajahn Chah's simile. Okay, here it comes. That he said that his monastery was a mango garden, a mango orchard, sorry. And the mango trees were planted by the Buddha. And there's heaps and heaps and heaps of juicy, sweet mangoes on those trees. But you can't climb the trees to get a mango. You can't throw up a stick to get it. You can't get a cherry picker. You can't blow up the tree and push it over to get the mangoes. There's only one way only to get the mangoes from the trees planted by the Buddha. And that is to sit perfectly still under the tree. Hold out your hand and a mango will fall. That's what he said. That's one of the first talks he gave when I arrived in Wat Pa Phong 47 years ago. And I thought that was crazy stuff. What's he talking about? You know, if you sat under a tree, a mango tree or any old tree, has anything ever fell on you? Maybe on your head, but never in your hand. But that's just an amazing, beautiful simile. You sit perfectly still. That's how you develop these things. You don't want anything. You don't do anything. You don't move. Holding out your hand is opening compassion. The door of my heart is open for you, mango. A lot of times you don't believe that. You think that's impossible. You'd be sitting under that tree all year and nothing would happen. But then what happens is you actually do that, and then it works. Oh, crikey. Some of these monks were just brilliant. That wasn't the Buddha's simile, that was Ajahn Chah's. Incredible brilliance. It really taught me that he knew what he was talking about. You don't develop it in the sense of making it happen. You leave it alone, and it happens by itself. Is that okay? Okay, so find a nice mango tree, sit underneath it and don't move. That's right here, isn't it? Okay, so I better sort of go off and do the interviews now, but was that the question which was written 2 or 3 days ago? Okay, so somebody wrote a similar question, but the question's disappeared. If it came from anybody, or it came from, or it came from you? Oh, I shall so act. Yeah, so it's not so act, but I shall so not do. I shall sit peacefully. You find out what the problem was and you get the solution, yeah? Okay, the I shall so act, so what was going to happen? So these things don't come in again. Yeah, so it's just when there's a problem in life, I shall so act that the problem doesn't come back again. And so in this particular case, make sure that these defilements, these imperfections, don't arise again. Is that what you're saying?
The question was asking whether that particular sutta, the Buddha was referring to going back to the preliminary stage of the breast of training, or whether in that particular sutta,
basically, whatever works. And most of the time, it comes to the deep stuff of meditation. Whatever works is like learning how to be pretty still. But thank you for mentioning that determining, programming mindfulness. Because that was, I never mentioned that here, so thank you for that. That this is, say, you know, you get nimittas, but always sort of tend to get excited or get afraid or whatever. And if you say when these nimittas come, I won't get afraid, that is just too disturbing. And you'll find the nimitta will just get shattered. So what can you do? So what you do is at the beginning of meditation, if your meditation is getting really good and very deep, you say to yourself, at the very beginning of the meditation, you close your eyes, you're relaxed, you say, if I see a nimitta, I will not be excited. If I see a nimitta, I will not be excited. If I see a nimitta, I will not be excited. In your own words. Keep it brief, three times, then forget it. Don't keep on, I must remember, I must remember, I must remember. No, that's too disturbing. Trust your mind, you've programmed it. And then when you get to those stages of meditation, it's amazing how it works. It worked for me and it worked for many other people. Because what happens, you get to that stage and you're about to get excited, like you've done it so many times. But like an antivirus, it kicks in. You don't get excited. You don't say anything. The program has been put in at the beginning. And now it's just natural, automatic, and you get past. Is that sort of roughly right? Enough for now. Okay, you can write a question this evening, if necessary. Okay, great. So, now we do the Arahang Sama Sambuddho. As usually, I am late. Oh my goodness me. Was it worth it? Okay. And thank you in Singapore for waiting a little longer. Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangham Namami. Very good. And now we do the other way of ending a good talk. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good.